Hi, Dave Emery here. This is, for the record, program number 1169, the corporate foundations of the current malaise. This is being recorded on December 13th of the year 2020. Before getting into the subject matter of the program, I want to make a couple of notes. First of all, for those of you who like podcasts, sister station WFMU is podcasting, for the record, and there is a link at the top of each description on the SpitfireList.com website, and you can use that to basically sign up for the podcast. There is also, you can also visit the WFMU.org website to sign up for the podcast as well. Speaking of the SpitfireList.com website, there was a problem with the security certificate and the way it had been implemented that made the front page of the website look really bizarre and unsightly. That has been fixed. So if you have avoided visiting the website for that reason, be aware that that has now been fixed. The security certificate has been adjusted so that everything looks good. And again, speaking of the SpitfireList.com website, the latest iteration of the 32-gigabyte flash drive containing all of the work through For the Record program number 1156, the old archive shows, the miscellaneous archive shows, the anti-fascist archives, the Guns of November, the lecture series, the books, the old anti-fascist books, which will be featured to an extent on this program. Those are all available, basically all of my 41, well now, yep, at this point, 41 plus years on the air is available, and there is a link at, again, the top of each description on the SpitfireList.com website, and I can't encourage people strongly enough to get that flash drive and to make themselves something of a an archive or a preserving element for a future that looks very dark and that I believe is going to see the apotheosis of our civilization. They don't call me Good Time Dave Emery for nothing, you know. By the way, I get no money from that flash drive, nor do I get anything from the website or from the programs that I have done for 41 plus years. Now, as far as this program, there is, as I'm speaking on December 13th of 2020, something of a quasi-insurrection by the Trump elements of the GOP, which really dominate the GOP. There have been demonstrations in various places, some of which have been violent, right-wing slash neo-fascist. Groups like the Proud Boys have been weighing in on behalf of Trump, and really much of the Republican Party has been openly denying the validity of the 2020 election results. And the very real possibility of violence, of an escalated nature down the road and probably not very far down the road is something that I for one expect. This does not come as a surprise to me. And I think before getting back into the BioPsyop Apocalypse series and the coverage of the COVID-19 pandemic, which I hope to wind up relatively soon, I think talking about what was taking place during the course of World War II and even before, and what took place in the immediate aftermath of World War II is worth considering once again, because what is taking place now is the transformation or the transmogrification of an elite Nazi slash fascist philosophy into a broad-based popular movement. What was being implemented and manifested in the boardrooms of corporate America and around the world, chiefly in Germany and Switzerland, and what was, in as a direct outgrowth of that, what was taking place in the headquarters of various espionage organizations, the American World War II OSS organization, the post-war CIA, both when it incorporated the Fremdeherr Ost and SS cadre of Reinhard Gehlen, and when that latter became the BND, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, the West German, now the German, intelligence service. Our media and our academic institutions have not really recorded this as they should have, and that is one of the main reasons why this is going on. As I said in the recently concluded four-part Farewell America series, those who are looking at the open rejection of the 2020 elections and the people who fear, rightly in my opinion, the outcropping of political violence in this country and are bemoaning the threat to American democracy or how this besmirches American democracy or how it represents a rejection of American democracy, are basically closing the barn door long after the horse has escaped. Because, again, the foundation for what is happening now took place many decades ago, again, and prior to, during, and in the immediate aftermath of World War II, and the things manifesting now at a popular slash populist level, the pro-Trump demonstrations, Stop the Steal, etc., are essentially a popular manifestation of phenomena that were at the very epicenter of transnational and American corporate power and American and international espionage power, to coin a term. We're going to talk about this because I think being what in Boston would be called an old thought, I'm not necessarily in touch with younger people. I don't know how many younger people even listen to this program. But I think to understand what is going on now, it is essential to grasp what, again, our journalistic and academic institutions have failed to present. And I think that failure is absolutely willful. And as we await what I suspect will be an uptick in political violence in this country, bear in mind that the assassination of JFK, his brother Robert, Martin Luther King, and a whole lot of other people have paved the way for this, and yet there is no recognition of the reality of political murder as an established institution in the U.S. And so, by way of taking a look at the garden in which the seeds of fascism were planted, in which they were nourished, in which they sprouted and blossomed and bore fruit, which in turn seeded and sprouted and blossomed and bore fruit, and the upshot of which is, again, the transformation of what was an elitist ideology and phenomenon in the most significant corridors of corporate power in the U.S. and elsewhere, is now manifesting on Main Street. And I think it is going to get much, much worse. By way of something I think that really embodies the essence of what is taking place concerns a communication that took place in 1944. We have spoken in many programs, including for the record 411, number 506, about what was known as the Battle of Leuna in World War II. That's spelled capital L-E-U-N-A. I have mispronounced that as Leuna in past programs. Again, it is a city in Germany. It was in the former East Germany. It is called capital L-E-U-N-A, pronounced Leuna. That was the site of the largest and most important IG Farben synthetic fuel plant, and it was the IG Farben synthetic fuel plants which churned out the fuel, the synthesized fuel from the Bergius or Fischer-Tropsch process to produce the fuel and other chemicals that the Third Reich used to wage war, as we have looked at in the Uncle Sam and the Swastika program, among others. That development, the massive and successful synthesis of fuel, gasoline from coal by IG Farben, that fueled the Third Reich war machine, and that was the direct outgrowth of the standard IG agreement of 1929 and the tremendous capital that IG got, a significant block of Standard Oil stock, became part of the Hermann Schmitz Trust, and that in turn was folded into the Bormann organization, as we looked at in our last program. Throughout most of World War II, Allied bombing did not touch the IG Farben synthetic gasoline plants, permitting Germany to continue to wage war. And indeed, when finally in 1944, the most significant of those plants, Leuna, came under sustained bombing and thereby crippled German fuel production, it occasioned a very curious conversation. By the way, when the combat of World War II drew to a close, German heavy industry was largely intact, and that in no small measure was because of the powerful transatlantic corporate connections that we will be touching on in this program. One of the books that is available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website, it is on the flash drive, and it figured prominently in the original Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast on May 23rd of 1980 as All Honorable Men by James Stewart Martin. Martin was in charge of the economic warfare section of the antitrust division of the Department of Justice during World War II, working with, among others, Joseph Borkin, the co-author of the book that we're going to excerpt in just a minute, The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben. And they were in charge with, that is to say, that unit, the economic warfare section of the antitrust division of the Department of Justice, was charged with breaking up the transatlantic corporate / cartel agreements which permitted Germany to wage war and which hamstrung American industry during World War II. James Stewart Martin was unsuccessful in his attempts at breaking up the German cartels, and something that I think really shows us what was going on. And this is during World War II. And that is a, quote, gentleman's agreement. One of the things that one learns by studying books like All Honorable Men is that by the period between the world wars, the nation state as such had become obsolete. It was the cartel state, to coin the term, or the transnational corporate state and the networks thereof or therein that really was and is the dominant power consideration in the world. The aforementioned bombing of Leuna, again, the largest of the IG Farben synthetic fuel plants, occasioned an interesting conversation. Turning now to the book that I alluded to, The Crime and Punishment of IG Farben, co-authored by Joseph Borkin and Barry Zwicker, Z-W-I-C-K-E-R, published in hardcover by the Free Press. We take a look at the conversation between Heinrich Butefisch, the IG Farben official in charge of Leuna, and one of Germany's top nuclear scientists, someone named Paul Hartek, H-A-R-T-E-C-K. And this was after the bombing of Leuna. The intensive bombing of Leuna led to a curious confrontation between Butefisch, who was in charge of Leuna, and Paul Hartek, H-A-R-T-E-C-K, a leading nuclear scientist working on Germany's atomic bomb project. Part of Leuna was devoted to the manufacture of heavy water, a necessary component of atomic energy. After the first bombs fell on Leuna, Butefisch informed Hartek that the heavy water installation must be abandoned. He claimed that the massive bombing of Leuna could not have been aimed at fuel production since there was a gentleman's agreement, unquote, between heavy industry and Germany and abroad that IG's synthetic gasoline plants would not be bombed. The only explanation for the raids against Leuna, therefore, was the heavy water facility. One more time. Butefisch claimed that the massive bombing could not have been aimed at fuel production since there was a gentleman's agreement, unquote, between heavy industry in Germany and abroad that IG's synthetic gasoline plants would not be bombed. The only explanation for the raids against Leuna, therefore, was the heavy water facility. In For the Record 1142, we look at information from the book Gold Warriors by Sterling and Peggy Seagrave that discussed the fact that much the same was true in Japan as well, although residential areas had been subjected to the most savage firebombing even before the atomic bombings, and the average Japanese residential districts had been liquidated with tremendous loss of life, and although the average Japanese was impoverished, having to work two jobs a day in order to earn enough to get to pay for a single potato, not only was Japanese infrastructure more or less intact at the end of the war, but the Japanese power elite, who were part of this same transnational corporate foundation, were basically doing very well for themselves. But this, quote, gentleman's agreement, unquote, and indeed the IG plants, synthetic gasoline plants, largely escaped bombing for most of the war until in 1944. The bombing of the Leuna plant obliged the cannibalization of much of the infrastructure and the personnel from the other plants to keep going. It fatally crippled Germany's fuel production, and that helped to bring Germany to its knees from an industrial standpoint, although at the end of the war, German heavy industry was largely intact. One of the things to keep in mind, we have spoken many times, and including in our last program, about the Bormann Flight Capital Organization. Martin Bormann, that is the Reichsleiter, set up 750 corporations in neutral countries, mostly in neutral countries, and they became the repositories of tremendous amounts of capital and also patents and technical know-how that helped to fuel the, basically helped to drive German corporate and economic revival in the post-war period. One of the things that needs to be borne in mind, and that is the not only the transnational corporate connections that Boyfefisch was talking about in the Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben, but the fact that the Bormann organization has tremendous capital participation in corporate America. This is on top of the tremendous investment that the U.S. had in German industry, and that German industry had in the U.S. as well. That was the relationship that we talked about in Uncle Sam and the Swastika, and that was highlighted in that passage from The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben. As we take a look at what is taking place today, bear in mind that not only has corporate ownership, corporate stock ownership been concentrated in the U.S., for example. More than 50% of all stock holdings are held by 1% of the population. When someone owns 2% or more in one of these major corporations, that may not seem like much, but in the age of electronic trading, when the stock in one of these giant mega corporations undergoes sale and 2% or more is sold, that can trigger electronic trading and can produce a devastating run on the price of that stock. So when someone or a corporation, or in this case the Bormann Network, owns 2% or more of the stock in a given corporate entity, that is tremendously significant. We're going to visit another of the books that is available on the SpitfireList.com website. That is the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, whose work on the remarkable and deadly Bormann organization, again, the entity that I feel will prove to be the decisive element in human affairs on this planet. Paul Manning's research was underwritten, financed by CBS News. Paul Manning undertook the investigation into Bormann and his network with the encouragement of his close friend and professional colleague Edward R. Murrow. However, it was this very corporate pressure, the very corporate participation and connections of the Bormann organization that helped to block CBS from going forward. CBS did not go with the story. And then For the Record 152, and also in For the Record 604, we talked about the pressure that helped to block the discussion of the Bormann organization. Now, of the capital relationship at one level between American and German corporations prior to and during the war, and as we will see, of the Bormann organization's resumption and acceleration of purchase in corporate America, we read as follows from Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning. And after discussing the successful transfer of capital to those aforementioned 750 new corporations, we read, "With such funds accumulating rapidly in Spain, Portugal, Sweden, Switzerland, and Argentina, Bormann and his group, who were handling the fortunes of 750 new corporations, would use these corporations in neutral countries as cloaks for investing in American companies. Bormann always had a high regard for U.S. blue-chip stocks as a stable investment, consistently purchasing a vast number of shares from the European offices of such New York stock brokerage houses as Merrill Lynch on behalf of the Reich Chancellery and Hitler, until war became official between the U.S. and Germany, and the buying stopped for a time. In 1941, investments in U.S. corporations by German companies and assorted German individuals held voting ownership in 170. Minority ownership was held in another 108 American companies. These businesses covered the following fields: manufacturing, foodstuffs, chemicals, electrical and automobile equipment, machinery and machine equipment and other metal products, petroleum production, refining and distribution, again, petroleum production, refining and distribution, finance, trade, and miscellaneous. American industry, of course, had a financial stake in German industry. In the same year, 1941, 171 U.S. corporations had major investments in German firms amounting to $420 million. A listing of these corporations is identical to the general categories under German ownership in the United States. When Bormann gave the order for his representatives to resume purchases of American corporate stocks, it was usually done through the neutral countries of Switzerland and Argentina. From foreign exchange funds on deposit in Swiss banks and in Deutsche Südamerikanische Bank, the Buenos Aires branch of Deutsche Bank, large demand deposits were placed in the principal money center banks of New York City, National City, now Citibank, Chase, now Chase Manhattan, Manufacturers and Hanover, now Hanover's Trust, Morgan Guaranty, and Irving Trust. Such deposits are interest-free, and the banks can invest this money as they wish, thus turning tidy profits for themselves. In return, they provide reasonable services such as the purchase of stocks and transfer or payment of money on demand by customers of Deutsche Bank, such as representatives of the Bormann business organizations and Martin Bormann himself, who has demand accounts in three New York City banks. They continue to do so. The German investment in American corporations from these sources exceeded $5 billion and made the Bormann economic structure a web of power and influence. The two German-owned banks of Spain, Banco Alemán Transatlántico, now Banco Comercial Transatlántico, and Banco Germánico de la América del Sur S.A., a subsidiary of Deutsche Bank, served to channel German money from Spain to South America, where further investments were made. And something to keep in mind is that, as we will see, not only were it should not be misunderstood as I don't want to be misunderstood as claiming, well, it was the Bormann group that corrupted the pristine integrity of corporate America. Far from it. They liked what the Third Reich did. Many of the most powerful power brokers, people like the Dulles brothers, John Foster and Alan Dulles, people like Frank Wisner, William Donovan, William Casey, they thought that what the Germans were doing was quite good. The dominant motivation was anti-communism. And indeed, some of the most powerful corporate interests in the U.S. tried to overthrow Franklin Roosevelt in 1934. But added to that is the role of the Bormann Network. And as we watch the maneuverings of corporate America, or really the transnational corporations, bear in mind that the Nazi participation in this is absolutely profound. Returning again to Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, about the FBI file on Martin Bormann that had been obtained by Paul Manning. That file revealed that Borman had been banking under his own name from this office in Germany in Deutsche Bank of Buenos Aires since 1941. That he held one joint account with the Argentinian dictator Juan Perón, and on August 4th, August 5th, and August 14th of 1967, had written checks on demand accounts in First National Citibank Overseas Division of New York, the Chase Manhattan Bank, and Manufacturers Hanover Trust Company, all of which cleared through Deutsche Bank of Buenos Aires. And again, as we have seen in our discussions of the Borman Group, in addition to the economic links, Heinrich Müller, head of the Gestapo in World War II and the security director for the Borman Network, went to work with U.S. intelligence during the post-war period. And during the Cold War, the Borman Network and Heinrich Müller collaborated with U.S. intelligence. These checks, I should say, were written on demand accounts on August 4th, 5th, and 14th of 1967. In April and June of the following year, Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy were assassinated. One wonders if the three checks over a 10-day period in 67 had anything to do with that. And as something of a pivot point to our return to an unpublished essay that I used in For the Record programs number 1149 and 1150, turning once again to Martin Borman, Nazi in exile. Also, Borman felt that Fritz Thyssen was his ace in the hole if he ever needed a pipeline to Alan Dubellis. The Thyssen interests are front and center in not only the Borman Network, but also in the transatlantic corporate axis that I have spoken about in the past. At the very epicenter of the Thyssen operation were several generations of the Bush family, and indeed the aforementioned Loima plant was subsequently purchased by Thyssen AG. And now Thyssen has merged with Thyssen Krupp. We talked about the after the reunification of Germany, Thyssen AG's purchase of the Loima plant in some of our discussions, including For the Record 506. And Alan Dulles, along with his brother John Foster Dulles, a fellow partner in the consummately powerful Sullivan and Cromwell Wall Street law firm, was head of the CIA under Dwight Eisenhower, while his brother, John Foster Dulles, was the Secretary of State. And Foster Dulles actually put together I.G. Farben, hammered together that cartel, as we have looked at in a number of programs. There is discussion of that in the introduction to the anti-fascist books on the SpitfireList.com website. And as background to our discussion of I.G. Farben, which appears to be a dominant element in Pfizer-BioNTech certainly a very significant element in the Pfizer BioNTech firm that developed the vaccine that is the front runner. It's been approved in a number of countries, including the UK and Canada, and now appears to be getting emergency authorization from the FDA. By way of taking a look at how I.G. Farben was part and parcel to this transnational corporate axis, and how the corporate power of which I.G. Farben was a principal part has merged with intelligence operations, and in turn, that was part of the corporate foundation for the current malaise. Because what is happening now, as I've said several times, should be no surprise. It is the translation of a fascist slash Nazi philosophy that was dominant in Wall Street law firms and in the directorships of corporate America to a mass movement. Not just corporate America, but the transnational corporate or cartel milieu. And in For the Record program 1149 and again in 1150, we looked at some of the information I'm about to recap. I'm also going to add a lot of information to that. So if some of this appears to well, really lack the supplemental discussion that would be necessary. It is because we have done that in For the Record 1149 and 1150, and that will be those programs, and also a Food for Thought post will be linked in the written description for the program. We're going to turn now to an unpublished essay called Mengele and Belus, The SS-OSS Connection, Transnationalism, and the Cold War. Now, this author is someone well-known to veteran listeners. However, because this book was never published, it will remain anonymous. Again, we use this in 1149 and 1150. One relatively low instance of this, the subsidy of revanchist ethnic groups in the United States, was apparently taken over by the Gehlen Organization, later the West German Bundesnachrichtendienst, or BND, from Frank Wisner's OPC. At some point, apparently in the 1960s, the FBI investigated, quoting now from Gehlen's Spy of the Century by E.H. Cookridge, one more time. At some point, apparently in the 1960s, the FBI investigated the large organizations of Ukrainians, Poles, Lithuanians, Latvians, and other East European immigrants in the U.S., which received finance and advice from three registered BND agents. Roman Henninger, or Henninger, H-E-N-L-I-N-G-E-R, alias, quote, Dr. Grau, G-R-A-U, Victor Salomon, S-A-L-E-M-A-N-N, and Alexander Weber, W-I-E-B-E-R. The American authorities were, however, pacified when they were told that from these organizations, V-men were being recruited to be infiltrated into the communist orbit. V-men was what Gehlen called some of his undercover operatives who were infiltrated again into the former Soviet Union and Warsaw Pact countries. In other words, the FBI was persuaded to ignore the political activities of the three groups, not the least of which was to help consolidate the original American support for the World Anti-Communist League. Other political groups and lobbyists were subsidized by Gehlen and the BND without even an excuse of an intelligence pretext. One was the Federation of American Citizens of German Descent in the U.S., whose chairman, Austin App, an associate of former WACO chairman Roger Pearson, is attempting to debunk the historicity of the SS Holocaust. Another was the right-wing public relations firm of Washington lobbyist Julius Klein, who, according to one of Klaus Barbie's counterintelligence corps handlers, had a special relationship, unquote, with Barbie in Germany at the time. Klein, representing, quote, the Committee for Return of Confiscated German and Japanese Property, unquote, lobbied unsuccessfully for a 1954 bill introduced by Senator Dirksen, that's Everett Dirksen of Illinois, which would have contravened the 1945 German Reparations Agreement and restored the U.S. properties of IG Farben to their German owners. A supporter of this bill, which was vigorously opposed by the Justice Department, was Secretary of State John Foster Dulles. Again, along with, he was Secretary of State under Eisenhower. He put together the IG Farben cartel to begin with, and he also was the brother of his fellow Sullivan and Cromwell partner Alan Dulles, who was head of the CIA at the same time. And Alan Dulles, again, was front and center in the negotiations between the SS and the OSS, which ultimately helped to set up the CIA in no small measure as a repository for the SS cadres that were part of the Gehlen organization when it was from the Heere Ost under the Third Reich, and they basically then jumped to the CIA and then to ultimately to the BND when it became the West German and now the German Intelligence Service. The author here goes on. Here we see how intelligence funds, recruitment resulting from the OSS-SS conspiracy, were used to supplement the political influence of the transnational firms like IG Farben, whose influence helped generate the OSS-SS conspiracy in the first place. One more time. Here we see how intelligence funds, resulting from the OSS-SS conspiracy, was used to supplement the political influence of the transnational firms like I.G. Farben, whose influence helped generate the OSS-SS conspiracy in the first place. This is hardly surprising, since American transnationals, when solicited by Frank Wisner, contributed, quote, large sums of money, unquote, toward the estimated $200 million which CIA and the Office of Policy Coordination, according to E.H. Cookridge, contributed to the support of the Galen organization. Another way to put it is that the Galen I.G. Farben overlap of the post-war period merely perpetuated the SS I.G. Farben overlap of the Nazi 1930s, when I.G. Farben's own Foreign Intelligence Network, NW7, financed the Sicherheitsdienst spy network, the AO, Auslandorganisation, or Organization of Germans Abroad, setting up, quote, an army of 5,000 secret agents headed by Nazi Consul Fritz Wiedemann, W-I-E-D-E-M-A-N-N, in San Francisco, which penetrated North and South America. The SD, or Sicherheitsdienst, was the SS intelligence service, and we talked about the Berlin NW7 espionage office under Max Ilgner in our last program, continuing with discussion of this. Two members of I.G. Farben's pre-war NW7, SS officer Gunther Frank Falle, that's F-R-A-N-K hyphen F-A-H-L-E, and Prince Bernhard of Holland, were able to reestablish themselves in the business of international intelligence and political payoffs, but now with American backers. And in a footnote, the author notes, Prince Bernhard's marriage to Princess Juliana of the Netherlands was allegedly arranged by I.G. Farben director Gerhard Fritze, F-R-I-T-Z-E, a relative of NW7 chief Max Ilgner, who was himself a nephew of I.G. Farben director Hermann Schmitz. And continuing with talking about Gunther SS officer Gunther Frank Falle and Prince Bernhard, also of the SS. Again, he became basically the, he married the Queen of the Netherlands. Continuing. Those two became, along with OSS veteran Nicholas Beek, D-E-A-K of Beek and Company, part of the huge transnational net of Lockheed agents, transmitting to their own ample profit large sums of money to right-wing German politicians such as Franz Josef Strauss, chief spokesman for a vigorous West German role in NATO. It has been recently confirmed in criminal court proceedings that U.S. intelligence funds, officially those of the U.S. Air Force, but by other accounts with CIA involvement and approval, used the Lockheed payments as a cloak for their own political payoffs. Speaking about CIA penetration of the Third World, an investigating Select Senate Committee under Senator Frank Church found a worldwide system of CIA payoffs was generating a, quote, worldwide infrastructure of agents. And then quoting from the Church Committee report, financial support was provided to parties, candidates, and incumbent leaders of almost every political persuasion except the extreme left and right. The immediate purpose of these projects was to encourage political stability and thus prevent communist incursions, but another important objective of political action was the acquisition of, quote, agents of influence, unquote, who could be used at a future date to provide intelligence or to carry out political action. Through such projects, the CIA developed a worldwide infrastructure of individual agents or networks of agents engaged in a variety of covert activities. You might say that the CIA was extending the system of international Tammany politics, which helped secure the Western allegiance of post-war Italy and Germany. Or you might say that the CIA was merely consolidating, with unvouchered public funds, the system of transnational corruption that had characterized the practice of transnational corporations. The paths of corporate and of CIA payoff tend to overlap. For once a politician has been bought, he can be bought by all. If there is any major Western industrialized nation whose post-war politics have not been visibly tainted by Lockheed or CIA payoffs, it is probably the United States of America. Here, the pattern of IG Farben payoffs to American officials, a story which goes back to the forced resignation of Warren Harding's Attorney General Harry M. Daugherty, apparently continues, even if the facts are sometimes hard to establish. In the interwar years, much of this influence was exercised by Sterling Drugs, the American component of IG Farben's worldwide Bayer cartel. Through Sterling, IG Farben had access to American presidents, first through Hoover's secretary, President Herbert Hoover. Through Sterling, IG Farben had access to American presidents, first through Hoover's secretary Edward T. Clark, a Sterling vice president, and later Roosevelt's brain truster Tommy the Corcoran, Sterling's official lawyer and later director. It also hired a convicted German agent and early Nazi Party member Edward A. Rumley, and used the Dulles brothers as one set of lawyers. As Europe moved toward war, Sterling moved to protect itself with the help of Alan Dulles' J. Henry Schobert Banking Corporation, its officers Weiss and McClintock, quote, put a large sum of money into the Democratic National Committee and the Republican National Committee as well to make sure that whoever won the presidency would prove supportive. In May of 1938, McClintock traveled to Basel, Switzerland to confer with Hermann Schmitz and Kurt von Schroeder during meetings of the Bank for International Settlements. The conference agreed that the vast funds earned by Sterling from distributing Bayer products to Latin America would be held in the J. Henry Schroeder Bank of New York until the end of the war. In return for this arrangement, Sterling products in Germany and in the countries Germany would occupy would be held in Kurt von Schroeder's Stein Bank in Cologne for the duration. As for the Bayer outlets in Latin America, which, as we have seen, became covers for first Abwehr and then Sicherheitsdienst spy networks and infiltration routes, these were commingled with Sterling's Latin American operation, handled after 1934 by David Corcoran, Tommy Corcoran's brother. A U.S. Assistant Attorney General reported to the Truman Defense Committee in 1942 that, quote, when the Nazi government pressed IG Farben for money in 1938, it drew on Sterling Products Incorporated for its subsidiaries, unquote. Various dispatches from embassies throughout 1943 assert that McClintock actually bribed Chilean government officials to enable him to continue business connections with the Nazis. The Sterling Corcoran connection continued into the post-war period when Tommy Corcoran's firm became one of the most influential of transnationals seeking help from CIA operations. One does not think of President Kennedy as a politician on the take. If he was easily corruptible, it was not with money. Yet questions were raised when the John F. Kennedy administration had arranged for $124 million to be paid to IG Farben's Swiss front, Imperhandel, for its American subsidiary, General Ameline and Film, which had been seized as enemy property in World War II. 15 years earlier, Abel Hamel had been willing to settle for a mere $14 million, a figure which Truman's Justice Department rejected as too high. These questions were increased when one of the principals, demanding a payment of $11 million for his own efforts in the case, charged that a sizable payment had been made to a Kennedy in-law, Prince Radziwill, quote, for a simple introduction to Robert Kennedy, unquote. By the way, Prince Radziwill was a white Russian and was part of Jackie's family, and there were some very strong fascist connections on that side of the family. And indeed, Kennedy's father had been heavily invested in Nazi Germany for a period of time. And as we have looked at in past programs, including AF 837, and also in our series of interviews with Russ Baker, author of Family of Secrets, George de Morenshield, in addition to his links to the Bush family, also had links to Jackie's family as well. Continuing and reviewing some information that we looked at in the aforementioned For the Record 1149 of 1150 to plug what we looked at into this transnational corporate connection. One of the most researched and ill-understood stories about such payments concerns a Bahamas casino, Paradise Island, which figured in investigative stories about Richard Nixon and Watergate. The casino was owned by an American company, Mary Carter Pape Company, later known as Resorts International, and there is no question but that in 1968, the chairman of the company, James Crosby, made a $100,000 contribution to the Nixon campaign. It took the unusual form of 34 checks, 33 of them for $3,000 apiece and the last for $1,000. In 1972, E. Howard Hunt, in his double capacity as an employee of the Nixon White House and of a CIA-linked public relations firm, the Robert Mullen Agency, did certain work for Interpel, an investigative and intelligence subsidiary of Resorts. Interpel was trying to hush up allegations based on a controversial internal memorandum from a woman named Beta Beard about a $400,000 payoff to the Republican Party in exchange for settlement of a Justice Department suit against IPP. In 1972, Crosby made no alleged contribution to Nixon, even though, Crosby made no acknowledged contribution to Nixon, even though he was reportedly asked by Nixon's personal lawyer, Herbert Kalmbach. But in 1973, the New York Times ran a story about peculiar movements between the Paradise Island Casino and the Key Biscayne Bank, which belonged to then-President Richard Nixon's friend, Baby Rebozo. There was speculation that the bank and the casino were laundering funds for the president. The story focused on the movements of a close friend of Rebozo called Seymour Alter, quote, whom a lot of people called Resorts Bagman, unquote. Testimony by an IRS informant to a House subcommittee 2 years later suggested that the money was in fact skim from another of James Crosby's companies, the Paradise Island Bridge Company, and that Alter had on at least one occasion carried $200,000 of such money and been met on the Key Biscayne Dock by B.B. Rebozo himself. I'm quoting, they headed for either B.B.'s or Nixon's house, unquote. Throughout the Watergate scandal, there were rumors among investigative reporters that Nixon and Rebozo were silent partners with Crosby in the lucrative bridge company. I myself was sent a list of the shareholders at this time. The list, later confirmed by Crosby in public testimony, did not show Nixon or Rebozo. He did, however, name a number of German and Swiss investors. One of these, for example, was Dr. Heinz Rosterg, R-O-S-T-E-R-G, of Lausanne, Switzerland, a former, quote, principal stockholder, unquote, and director of the Wintershall Potash Concern. Wintershall was one of the major subsidiaries of BASF, the largest single successor firm to IG Farben. By itself, this would be a tenuous link between the CIA-Galen-IG Farben connection and the alleged payments to Richard Nixon. But the same IRS informant testified to links They were corroborated by investigative journalists between Resorts International and a Bahamas bank, Castle Bank, which the Wall Street Journal later revealed to have had among its deposits, quote, a $5 million CIA fund, unquote. Castle Bank had been founded by an OSS and CIA veteran, Paul Helliwell, whose role in helping to consolidate the post-war CIA mafia narcotics connection I had described elsewhere. CIA's operational interest in the mob-connected Castle Bank was so great that, according to the Wall Street Journal, the Justice Department dropped its pursuit of Castle Bank under pressure from the CIA. The Wall Street Journal's revelation revived interest in a controversial claim printed 4 years earlier in the Rolling Stone magazine that Resorts International, quote, in its earlier incarnation as Mary Carter Paint, was a CIA front set up by former New York District Attorney and Governor Thomas Dewey and Alan Dulles, first chief of the CIA, to launder funds to support counterinsurgency groups in Latin America. Dewey, of course, ran for the Republican ticket in 1948. Dulles was his top campaign official. Continuing. After a suit for libel brought by Resorts, Rolling Stone magazine retracted the claim. Still unanswered is the question whether the story of the Dewey Allen Dulles interest in Resorts International should have referred to funds not from the CIA itself, but from its German-Swiss partners in the Paradise Island Bridge Company. Such an hypothesis might explain some of the many strange coincidences which surround the company's controversial history. It might, for example, explain, quote, the fortune in legal fees, unquote, that Mary Carter Paint, on the advice of the aforementioned Thomas Dewey, paid to Alan Dulles' longtime law partner David Peck. The SS-OSS connection certainly had reason to be grateful to Peck. It was on the basis of Peck's recommendation as chairman of a three-man advisory board to review all the Nuremberg sentences that U.S. High Commissioner for Germany and later Warren Commission member John J. McCloy commuted the time served the sentence of Skorzeny's post-war employer, Baron Alfred Krupp, and eight of his colleagues, and also ordered Krupp's property to be restored. The release of Krupp and other industrialists fulfilled an earlier demand to McCloy from Hermann Abs, who himself narrowly escaped prosecution at Nuremberg. Abs was the first post-war chairman of BASF, also head of Deutsche Bank, by the way, the IG Farben successor company represented among the stockholders of the Paradise Island Bridge Company. Might not the OSS-SS connection also throw light on the unexplained interlock between James Crosby's company Resorts International, tightly controlled by the related and doubly intermarried Crosby-Murphy families, and Capital Cities Broadcasting, the major investment of the CIA's present director, William Casey? By the way, this was in the 1980s. Casey would be the logical person to have established the original connection between the Crosby-Murphy families and their mysterious German-Swiss partners. For it was Casey, in 1944 and 1945, who, quote, was given overall operational control of OSS German projects, unquote, and again quoting, coordinated the over 150 men whom OSS sent in to Germany, unquote. With Dulles, Wisner, and Forgan, Casey was also one of the OSS veterans who lobbied successfully for a CIA which could legitimately utilize the resources of the Galen organization and its CNSS cadres. And again, this last part, I have not got time to go into it with as much supplemental discussion, but this is the foundation of what is taking place today. So if it seems untoward, if it seems unusual, it shouldn't. This concludes For the Record program number 1169. The corporate connection, the corporate foundation of the present malaise. This is being recorded on December 13th of the year 2020. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.